I had this idea that like being a father was sort of like writing a novel in the sense that it was like this lion in the road. It was like, there's this challenge up ahead and it's a worthy challenge. And you might not be living your best life if you try and duck it. That's what I sort of felt about fatherhood.
Welcome to the Dadwell podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with Dave Reedy. Dave is Vice President of Creative for Closer Look and the author of Captive Audience, a collection of short stories about performers, as well as the novel The Voiceover Artist. These days, Dave is writing nonfiction. In a series of essays, after spending years researching every facet of the man's life, he's examining the parenting legacy of the grandfather he never knew, the parables he told, the poems he recited from memory, his thoughts on working for a living, and assessing their value for himself and his own sons. Dave is dad to two young sons, ages 7.5 and 5. In this episode, Dave explains how he eventually integrated his dad identity with his writer identity, and how the melding of the two altered his approach to writing. We talk about the importance of treating inspiration and epiphanies with respect, and some practical tips for capturing those moments on the go. Lastly, we talk about emotional intelligence and how this attribute made his father a very successful federal prosecutor, but also equipped his young sons with tools for expressing themselves and relating to others.
Have you talked to your kids about it? Did they know you're doing this?
You know, they don't actually. I haven't talked to them about it.
I think that's the bigger question. Like, would they
even
care?
Good question. I think they would, because, you know, they know I listen to podcasts and they've listened to podcasts too. I think the idea that I might be on a podcast would be interesting to them. I actually did my first recorded interview with them about a month ago for an essay that I actually have just finished and I'm getting ready to send out. And I called it an interview and I went through the whole thing, even though, you know, they're young. I thought it was important to, you know, treat them with the respect I would accord any kind of interview subject, but then also show them a little bit about how this is done. Like I asked for their permission to be recorded on mic. They granted it. It was great. And I think they thought it was cool to be interacting with me in that way around kind of a creative project. So I'll probably tell them about this at some point. Whether or not they listen to it or not, we'll have to see. I'll have to see where we go with it. But I'll definitely tell them we do it.
Nice. So I'd love to start with your own origin story, if you will, and,
sure.
And have you tell me about your own dad or other father figures you had growing up.
Yeah, sure. So let's see, my dad is just about 70 years old. He grew up on the southwest side of Chicago in what was a pretty homogenous neighborhood then. A lot of Irish folks, German folks, overwhelmingly Catholic. And he met my mom. They got married at 21. They didn't have me till they were 27 years old or nearly. But yeah, my dad was involved, very, very busy, but involved. He worked a lot. He traveled a fair amount. But I recall him often being at my games and recitals and things like that. He would make himself, you know, reasonably vulnerable in front of me for a man of his generation, you know, and he had a temper when I was younger, for sure. Something that I have definitely tried to nip in the bud and wrestle with as a dad. And because I don't really want it playing outside of my control. He was also, you know, like I said, very affectionate and present to us. I'm the oldest of four. I have two brothers and a sister. Yeah, he liked to play with us. He would entertain our wild opinions. He'd tend to treat us with respect and talk to us about real issues even before we were kind of, you know, ready to have fully formed opinions about them. He let us kind of spar at the dinner table and kind of work our reasoning muscles a little bit. And so I just kind of have recollections of him as present and loving. And, you know, importantly, as I look at myself as a dad, he was imperfect. He was not perfect. And it turns out he didn't have to be to still be a really good dad.
Yeah. What is he, or what did he do for a living?
From the time I was born until I was about 10 or 11, My dad worked for the government as in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, prosecuting federal cases. And then he went into private practice when I was around 10 or 11. My dad actually is himself a public figure, and by many accounts was, you know, just one of the best trial lawyers of his generation in the areas in which he practiced. He's a really, really smart and pretty charismatic guy. He was able to do the kind of connection work you need to do with juries and with his clients and with actually the attorneys on the other side, because in addition to being very sort of rationally intelligent, he's highly emotionally intelligent, and he values that too. And I think it really served him well, probably in all areas of his life, but certainly in his career.
So he's an attorney, and you're not an attorney.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering how his occupation, or maybe he had hobbies too, that that influenced early creative pursuits for you.
I think that they have. And I should say probably that I thought for a long time that I was going to be an attorney, probably even 3 years into college. But then after my junior year of college, I did a summer of working at a law firm. And I kind of experienced the utter lack of control I was going to have over my time if I was going to do that for a living as a young lawyer. I saw some very, very smart, very, very tired, very, very bedraggled young lawyers. And by then I was kind of beginning to write. That was the same summer I was beginning to write for myself, you know, outside of a newspaper or like a school newspaper or something like that. And I was writing my own stuff for the first time. And I kind of decided that summer that I wasn't going to rule out law school right away, but I was going to work really hard on writing. The very next fall, I was going to Ireland for study abroad. And I said, I'm going to write a lot there. And I ended up doing that, and I ended up choosing away from law school, which I think was a little disconcerting for my mother, but not so my father. I asked him one time if he was disappointed about that. He's like, no, look, you need to go do what you want to do. I know way too many really, really smart, really, really unhappy lawyers. So, I think you'd be really good at it, but you're not going to get any pressure from me to go do it. But in terms of the creative pursuits, I often dealt with topics that were sort of adjacent to my dad. I've done a lot of research and writing into the life of his father, and most recently trying to interrogate some of my paternal grandfather's legacy, some of the stories he told, the poems he memorized, the lessons he taught, his attitude toward work, and trying to see if any of those have value for me as a father or for my sons as young kids coming up. So, I mean, I think that my dad has definitely, you know, shown up in my work in various ways.
That's interesting. I love the new project. That sounds really, really rewarding and also just good research.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's been really interesting from a research perspective. Like, you know, I've gotten some help from some friends, like the writer Claire Zulke, who's a longtime friend of mine, a Chicago writer. You know, about just kind of how to go about some of these things journalistically, and then using some of my own kind of, knowledge about research to go to some sources outside of my family for information about a family member. Like I have, my grandfather was for part of his career a postal clerk. And so I have 15 years of employment records, from the government. I've got his military records. So it's just really interesting that, you know, in some ways I know things about him that his children don't know. And I never knew the man. He was dead before I was born.
Yeah.
So it has been cool. It's just now starting. I'm just now kind of figuring out how to write about it. You know, I've done a lot of writing about it, but in terms of writing about it in a way that's publishable, but I think this kind of looking at it from the angle of a father and, sharing some of these pieces of my grandfather with my sons, it's been pretty interesting. You know, and I think it's making for interesting work. I've shared the essay with a couple of writer pals, and I've read out from it from some of that writing at a couple of readings around Chicago, and the response has been pretty encouraging. So
that's cool. I'm excited to see that take shape. So you decide that you're not going to be a lawyer,
right?
And and that you're going to spend more time writing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of yourself as a writer at that time, or that you'll just be doing writing alongside another career path that's not being an attorney?
I actually adopted the identity of a writer well before I adopted the skill set. I was like, oh no, this feels right. I think I'm going to try this identity on, you know, tell some people, even like, you know, when they ask me like, what do I want to do? I'm going to say, you know, I want to be a writer. And, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways that was, you know, naive and presumptive, but I think when you're young and you're trying to make a go of something, part of what you're doing is you're trying to make a little bit of a social contract. Like you're sort of saying like, well, I've now said this, so I've got to go about trying to make it real. So, you know, that's, it can help to motivate you to get to your desk and get cranking. But I just really liked doing it. It was, you know, the people weren't really talking, at least not in my hearing, about concepts like flow, that kind of, you know, work state you can get into when time seems to disappear and you're fully immersed in your work. But writing was the shortest road for me into that state. And I really liked it. I really, really liked it.
Where did you encounter design in this trajectory?
So when I was just about finished with college, I didn't have a job lined up, and I knew, like, you know, no one was about to be publishing what I was writing, but I knew I wanted to keep trying to find a way to do it. And a friend of mine was like, well, where do you want to do this? I was like, well, I think I'm going to start in Chicago. And he said, have you thought about like advertising, you know, or a design firm or something like that? And I was like, well, I haven't really, but you know, that makes sense. I had done enough reading about, and it turns out there's actually a real rich tradition of writers in Chicago who have gone back and forth between sort of literary writing and advertising, going all the way back to like Sherwood Anderson and Ernest Hemingway. You know, kind of this triangle of journalism, advertising, and literary writing. There's a pretty long tradition of that in Chicago, and it continues to this day. Where I really first encountered design as a craft was in my first job with Kudal Partners, which is still a going concern, in a studio in Fulton Market area of Chicago. And I was lucky enough to get to join them when they were, you know, it was like an 8-person shop. I was one of two copywriters, you know, the owner and named partner, Jim Kudal, and Kevin Guilfoyle. Kevin Guilfoyle was a creative director, and then I was a copywriter, but I really got to learn a lot under those guys, a lot about writing in general, a lot about writing for advertising. Kevin himself became a really kind of celebrated author, published 2 books for Knopf. So I kind of got to see him pursue both at once, which was a good education for me. And I really did get to work with some really, 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 really great designers, and to come to appreciate good design worked, and how design and copy can come together and be something greater than the sum of their parts. And I was like, I did experience that then, as I still do now, as a kind of magic. And you're just like, wow, neither of these things alone would be what this thing is right now. When they can become kind of design and copy together, kind of in a big C creative, I find it really, really exciting. And when I work with my teams at Closer Look, I really try to hold that up for them as something that they should go for. And they very often get there. I hope it's as exciting for them as it is for me.
That's interesting. I didn't know that you came up through advertising.
And Kudal Partners did a lot of design for design's sake too. I mean, we had just, you know, we labored over our annual holiday gifts that, you know, there was every year it was hot sauce, but every year the packaging varied and, you know, conceptually from, you know, I think the best one we ever did was this sort of like 1970s auto repair box sort of inspired thing, as if the hot sauce bottle were a car part. And I got to work with Brian Bedell, who was an art director there at the time and still works with Kudal Partners. And I got to write a whole bunch of cool copy for that and kind of look at the old manuals and try and get the voice down. And it was great. And you know, in addition, I got to write ads that would show up in the newspaper. I got to write for restaurants and sort of some of their front of house copy. And my first exposure to shooting television commercials and producing, writing, and recording radio commercials, which would go on to really kind of influence the novel I wrote later, The Voiceover Artist. So yeah, I was 4.5 years at Kudal Partners, and I learned a ton. And I'm still still in touch with some of those folks too. So it's nice. I look back at how little I knew then. This will probably be a theme for us, Antonio, today. I don't know if it's been on your other conversations too, but like, you know, I'm learning largely as a dad through mistakes. And I think that's definitely true of me as a professional too. I mean, there are some things like I did, like, you know, just goofball shit, like showing up on a day I had a meeting in shorts because I forgot I had like a client meeting that day. And that was just not going to go. That's when I learned the trick of like, you know, look, if you're going to be wearing shorts to your job, you need to like keep pants at your office. And I was sort of like, I don't think I wore shorts in a non-athletic setting for like 15 years after that. I was just like, I'm off the shorts. I'm not doing it. I'm a grown man, damn it. And I got to start acting like one. But yeah, you know, I was very young and had some things to learn about how to be with other grownups in an office. But they gave me the room to learn that stuff, and I tried to do good work for them.
Yeah, I was always struck by Kodal Partners, just in that I don't remember the website offering any visibility into what they created for clients, and yes. It was so mysterious. And besides things like layer tennis and these other like creative things they supported.
Yeah.
It was a complete mystery how they like made any money or what they did.
Completely. I really think that Jim and the team now does a lot with field notes. And I think even then, even though it was a client driven business, Jim was beginning to try and feel out like, what would this be like if we were making what we liked and bringing it to an audience ourselves, like without doing it sort of for hire and for clients, or at least as often. And I think that Kudal.com was part of that. I mean, we all got to contribute to, you know, at the time it was a blog, right? You know, I mean, like we would post to it. We had tags of various kinds. I mean, I remember there was one of the big things was the MOOM, the Museum of Online Museums, which they would constantly, you know, link new museums up there. And it became this really cool repository. It was really about things we thought were cool and about creating a culture and a vibe and a place online that was distinctly Kudal Partners in a way that did not depend on our client work. And they did these really cool features that they'd let me edit called Field Tested Books, which was this kind of reader response exercise where we'd ask these creative people we knew, some from writing, but a lot of them from design or motion media. We'd say like, look, read a book somewhere that you don't live and, you know, do 150 words for us. And they'd sort the books by author of the blurb and by title of the book and by location it was read. So, I mean, somewhere out there, I think, is still a really big kind of compendium of those. And they got some, you know, some people who were big names at the time, and then some people who would become big names to participate in that. And they ended up putting a little perfect bound book together as well that's out there, and of kind of getting some of those things into print. They just did a lot of really cool things. And I think it was creative expression outside of a client context was really important to, you know, the folks who ran Kudal Partners. You know, I learned a lot from kind of their emphasis on that, even while they were really doing really good client work at the same time.
In the same vein of doing client work, but then leaving time and space to explore things, where did your writing, your you know, this personal writing that you had been developing in school, like where did that fit in, or what shape was it taking while you were working at agencies and doing client work?
If we're kind of thinking about the Kudal Partners era for me, which is kind of that 4.5 years right after college and before I went to grad school, I was kind of experimenting with what kind of form I wanted to be doing. I wrote a screenplay in college. I wrote a short stage play that got a little bit of attention from some contests. And I wrote a full length stage play that I workshopped with some playwrights over the Chicago Dramatists. I thought I was going to be able to find a form that I was just sort of uniquely suited to do and that was going to come easy. And then I tried enough forms to realize that none of these are easy, at least not for me. And so if they're all going to be hard, and if I'm going to be bad at all of them from the beginning, why not pick the one I really, really want to do? So I turned to prose and to fiction at that point. And I started writing short stories, as well as this kind of like, and we called it literary humor. How funny and how literary it was is up for debate. I think if you look back at some of it now, which hopefully no one does, I don't think it wears all that well. I think it shows some immaturity. I think it shows it was a different time. But at the time, the web felt like a place where you could, without a gatekeeper, try things out. And it was okay that it was rough, and it was okay that it wasn't perfect. So I would write a lot in the mornings and on the weekends as well, when I worked at Kudal Partners. And I would submit literary humor pieces to some of the magazines around that were doing that, like McSweeney's. You know, I got a couple of like just kind of listy things up on McSweeney's.net, and that was always really exciting because I had really admired what Dave Eggers was doing at the time, and just how sentence for sentence all the stuff was so funny and so creative and so well written. And then, you know, I was also trying to write short stories kind of tentatively. I sent one to a mentor of mine at one point. And one of the first ones I wrote, I was like, what do you think of this short story? I'm trying a short story. And he just wrote back. He was just like, try another one. And I was like, okay. Which I think was like, you know, his way of saying like, I'm going to spare you a critique of this story. Like, it was just like, sort of like, you finished a story. That's good. Go do another one. And, you know, luckily I had kind of gotten over the idea that I was just going to waltz right into a perfect piece. So I was willing to kind of throw my shoulder into another piece and editing them. And I got a few pieces together and eventually put together a grad school application for creative writing program in fiction. And that's when I decided to go to the University of Florida for a couple of years and write there.
Why did you return to Chicago? Or was that sort of always the plan when you headed off to Florida?
I think it was always my plan. I taught down there. I was just like reading and writing and hanging out with other writers and just really kind of doing it. And I was sort of like, well, I'd love to do more of that. But, you know, I didn't have a book coming right out of there. I was so like anything beyond adjunct teaching was not going to do it for me. I didn't see that I could make a living doing that. I was like, I think I might need to try and come back to Chicago. I'll try to come back to advertising or marketing, try to get hooked up with a cool place. And I'll try to live really, really close to that place. And so I can write in the morning or in the evening every day. So that's what I did. I came back and I found my way to Chicago. And my old roommate in Chicago was by that time a rising creative director at Closer Look. And he's like, look, we don't have a full-time copywriting staff here. I want to start one. I can start it with you I can try to find somebody who's like you. And I'd rather just start it with you if you would want to come work here. Are you up for that? And, you know, we did a couple of interviews on my last spring break. And then at the end of May or beginning of June, after grad school, I started there and I have been there almost 13 years.
Wow. That's a long time, man.
It is. Yeah. Especially in this industry. And I think that the company has changed a lot during that time. So it has been one place, but like, I feel like it's been like three or four different agencies in that time. So it's like impossible for it to get stale. Like it's an ambitious group of people who run it. So I feel like there's always kind of that next ring to catch. And then we also kind of are doing increasingly interesting work, getting to come up with campaigns that really define, you know, the next 12 to 18 months for a brand or a service line within a brand. So I'm really, really liking what we're doing now. And I'm proud that, you know, there was no copywriting there at the time. And now, you know, we got a lot of Chicago writers, a few of whom in the time that I've worked there have published their own work or their own books. And, you know, they've got a good way to make a living at a humane place where they can do good work in their day job. So, you know, I think that's by and large a good thing.
So tell me about the timing of your first book. Like, I feel like, did I hear this right? That like people come out of grad school with a book, like, is that the goal?
Sometimes, yeah.
Work your ass off and like publish something like that?
Yeah, some people come in there with a good deal of work. You know, they get admitted to the program with what might be a book or half a book. You know, I've even heard a story about a writer who basically showed up there with a publishable book, and the teacher was just like, all right, well, I'm going to introduce you to my agent, like before he'd taken any workshop classes. Oh, wow. And, you know, so, I mean, this kind of thing can come for people in various times and in various ways. But I left with a thesis. I completed a thesis of stories, but they weren't kind of cohering around any topic. But the ones that I liked best were about performers. And I was like, I'm going to see if I can write some more stories about performers and see if I can make this a book. And that did end up becoming Captive Audience, my first book, a collection of short stories about performers that came out in 2009. It was accepted for publication in May of 2008, which was almost exactly 2 years after I got out of school.
Tell me what your process was like working on a book. You're married or single when you're working on Captive Audience?
So when I was writing Captive Audience, I had a pretty serious girlfriend in graduate school. You know, we were together pretty much the whole time I was in graduate school, but it did not last past our graduation point. And so I wrote about half the stories in a relationship and then half the stories single. By the time Captive Audience was accepted for publication, I had been dating my now wife for about 5 months. It made for a very heady time. She was working at a theater she'd always wanted to work at. You know, we had found each other and were falling in love. I had a book accepted for publication by a Brooklyn publisher. It was like, we are going to be amazing. it was really heady stuff, you know, probably like on that cocktail of falling in love with someone too. Like, it was just like, this is incredible. And I think we imagined our trajectory as something that it was not actually, for both of us, both creatively and personally.
Where did you kind of feel like you were heading?
I think it was like
play it out for me.
I mean, I think it was something like, I think we're going to be together. I think we're going to have this family it seems like we want to have. And I think we're both going to make art for a living while we do it. I think that was the trajectory like we had in mind. Like, I think we dared to dream that it was going to be all about us, our family, and art, and the money would just sort of come from that. Which is naive in about a dozen ways. But it was heady, you know. And I mean, like, we just didn't know what these opportunities really meant. Did they mean we were on our way up, or were they going to be the peak point for a while? You know, it's like, I don't think we even asked ourselves that question. I think we just imagined we were going up, 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 you know, and that frankly, we imagined that that's the life that we wanted. Now, actually having children and thinking about trying to raise them with two people who are full-time artists, the very thought makes me really nervous. You know, some part of me thinks that that may not have been what I even wanted. It is one of the things I always wonder about that phase of my life is just, do I know myself better now, or did what I want change, or have I just adjusted to how things went? And I don't really know yet. I don't really have a great perspective on it. I've done a lot of thinking about it, a lot of writing about it. And I guess I just still don't know, but that was the trajectory, Antonio. We imagined it was like Tiff doing whatever she wanted in Chicago theater, and maybe beyond, me writing books and maybe, you know, maybe teaching or something, and us getting married and having kids. And some of those things happily have happened. I think that a lot of them just have taken longer than we imagined at that point when we were just, you know, just getting together and kind of experiencing these initial successes.
Yeah. So you went into the relationship, the two of you, sure about starting a family, having children. Is that right?
I learned early that was going to be part of the deal. Tiffany, as we were kind of getting serious, was like, just so you know, I mean, like, I intend to have children. And so if you don't intend to have children, you should let me know. You know, I gave that some thought, and I decided that, at least insofar as I knew then, I did want to have children, and I did want to have children with her.
When you gave it some thought, was it like, let me think about that for a second, or were you like, oh, well, why don't we end this date and I'm going to go home and think about it for a couple of weeks.
Right. Nope. It was nothing quite like that. It was much more like, look, I've imagined myself as a father before. I had this idea that like being a father was sort of like writing a novel, in the sense that it was like this, I don't know, to borrow a metaphor from someone, I can't remember who it was, Faulkner maybe, like this lion in the road. It was like this, there's this challenge up ahead, and it's a worthy challenge, and you might not be living your best life if you try and duck it. That's what I sort of felt about fatherhood, even though I had concerns about it and there are parts of it that frightened me. And also I thought like a good start to having kids was, you know, being with a woman who was dependable and loyal and loving, and who herself really wanted kids. You know, I was like, well, that's at least half of it. But I'd be lying if I said I went and pondered it and did like a silent retreat and a series of meditations about it. I just was sort of like, no, that sounds like I'm on board. I'm on board for that. Let's do it. I think she knew it was a good thing and was sort of like, let's get down to brass tacks. Let's figure out just how serious this can be and can get. Yeah, I give her credit too for having the tough conversations.
And did you think beyond the, like, okay, do I want to have kids? And, you know, is this the person I want to have them with? Did work or your writing, future books, you've got a handful of things you want to accomplish creatively. Maybe that list is very long. And then you've got all of the other things, you know, the other responsibilities and kind of demands for your time. And there's that reconciliation activity, if you will, or that exercise where you're sort of, okay, so if I say yes to this, what am I saying no to? Or what am I putting on pause? Or how exactly am I going to squeeze this in? You know, I feel like you described writing captive audience at all sorts of early times and with a lot of discipline. And is that right? You were, I mean, yeah. I feel like you were writing it.
It's fair. Yeah. I mean, I was writing, you know, I was... But my plan was like, look, when you work at an agency, you don't know necessarily as a younger creative, like when you're going to get to leave. You know, it's a client driven business. You don't always know how well your work's going to be received internally, and you've got deadlines to hit. And so I was like, you know, if I want to make sure I wrote in a given day, I have to do it early. I can work out late or something like that, but I can't really write completely gassed after like a 11-hour day, at least not all that often. For all the writing dreams that I have and have had, I've always been pretty serious about my work. Like I did not want to go there withholding and, you know, trying to marshal up the best of my energy. So I just kind of wanted to write, know that I had written that day, feel good about that, know that I had kind of chipped away at the project, and then go in there to work and like give it everything else that I had. So that kind of rhythm worked well for me. But I did not really know that when I said I was, you know, going to have children, and then when we got pregnant with our first, that was going to become, at least for a period, nearly impossible to maintain.
So what did it feel like when you realized that was the case?
Well, I mean, if you compound it with the fact that, you know, you've got this newborn baby, we weren't sleeping. Neither of our boys slept very well in the first year of their life. I was trying to do some approximation of, you know, decent co-parenting, even though Tiffany was nursing and, you know, she was definitely bearing the brunt, but I was, you know, I was often up too. And, you know, just reading all the, it just felt like it was the time when either they started writing or I started reading all these articles about just what interrupted sleep does to you. It's like a cognitive deficit equivalent to driving drunk. And you're just like, oh God.
Just imagine you staying up late reading these things.
Yeah, exactly. And also, of course, what I didn't know then is like the blue light from the screen wasn't then like interrupting my REM sleep. You know, so it just, all of it was just bad. Everything that, it seems like everything that I did just compounded the problem. You know, I went through periods of enormous frustration, of anxiety, of a sense of overwhelming failure. I definitely had periods of resentment, not of the children themselves, but taking one step back. So Tiffany and I had kind of committed to one another that we would try to protect one another's creative lives. I think that's what we were both kind of banking on, even though we knew that having children in the abstract would make it all harder. But, you know, it's very difficult for that to be executed evenly any way you measure it. You know, I would get in trouble when I would start counting the hours that Tiffany would spend in pursuit of theater versus the hours that I would get writing in a given 6 month period. And it's like, that way lies madness. You know, it was like, it was, you know, probably not even the most reasonable measure, but I think it was just sort of like, I would get focused on it because I was like, am I being taken advantage of here? You know, I'm the one with a full-time job and I'm like, am I getting taken advantage of here? And then it's like the very same questions Tiffany could have been asking while I was asleep and she was nursing the baby. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, you know, there was plenty of opportunity for people to look to feel resentful if they wanted to. And there were moments where we did and we were. Luckily, you know, we were able to recognize that wasn't super productive. And it wasn't going to create any more time for either of us. It would just kind of mire us in bad feeling. So we tended to move past it, but I didn't really get okay with this. My older son is going to be 8 in June. And like, I didn't really get okay with the way my life was vis-a-vis writing until like last year. Like I write less. I still write, but I write less and less predictably. But some combination of, you know, really finding my agency work real rewarding in the last 12 months and, you know, just sort of recognizing that, you know, I have these two books and it's not necessary for like it. I don't need a third one to be okay. I think that was the problem. Like I was like, I need to write in order to be okay. Like I didn't think I was enough. That's a heavy burden to carry around. You know, you're like, I need to do this to be enough. Like that was a pretty lousy way to feel, but somehow I managed to, you know, kind of write my way through that kind of while examining my grandfather's life and just realized that like, that is no way to go through life. But I was carrying that burden while trying to parent these kids and be a good creative partner and spouse. It led to some very, very unhappy moments.
This idea of enough, what's the criteria for you? And like, what are you measuring yourself against?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was deeper than that. I was sort of like, I am not enough, like as a person, unless I'm doing this or unless I'm producing this kind of work, or I'm not interesting enough. I'm not accomplished enough. I'm not living up to my potential sufficiently. I'm not worthy of, you know, the kind of accolades and attention I might once have wanted. It had a lot to do with identity and really just how my identity was under a lot of pressure as I learned to kind of integrate the dad part of my identity into the rest of it. The whole identity was in danger of splitting apart. It felt like it was just sort of like, I'm at real risk of not knowing exactly who I am and of losing sight of what is actually important. There were moments where I was really in danger of that.
And are you talking through this stuff with Tiffany or how did you... You mentioned writing your way out of it, but those are big things to wrestle with and to see your way through. How did you manage that?
I mean, I think we talked about it from time to time in various ways. I mean, Tiffany and I have a pretty open relationship, though I'll be honest and say sometimes I need to be drawn out into conversation. There are just some things I feel like I can't talk about it or just can't be shared even with someone that I know and love as well as I know Tiffany. I really was keeping a lot of it inside just because the times when I would talk about it, it didn't bring me any relief. Like I just felt more defeated. It became more clear that no one could help me with this and that I was going to have to take care of it myself. Either I was going to have to produce what I needed to produce to feel okay, or come up with a different way, a different criteria for feeling okay. And I did a lot of writing about my grandfather and about what his life was like through the lens of what my life was like and what a good life is, was, or could be for somebody who is a husband and a father and has some demons. So I did kind of probably spend more time writing about it, but I want to say one other thing. Our family went into like a family therapy for a couple of years, like, and we all went, the four of us, and it was motivated largely by me and Tiffany going like, we think we could be better parents to these two particular boys, like in a way that it was not like, oh, we'll go read a book and then we'll know how to do it better. It was like, no, these two particular boys, I feel like we could do better with these two particular boys if we got a little bit of coaching from someone who could watch us and watch them. And we managed to get some good coaching and some good sort of like principles that we could use that really helped us. And I think brought us all closer as a family. I don't want to act like I muscled through this writing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was doing a lot of writing at the time, but I think it's important to say that we as a family went to get some help, and we were fortunate that, you know, we had insurance that like made that possible, and that we benefited from it enormously, that I benefited from it individually. And I think each member of my family benefited from it individually. Yeah, I don't want to undersell that, because, you know, I know that it's not an opportunity available to everyone, but I actually think that, you know, mental health professionals are sort of more available to people than we might think. And, you know, there's more good advice out there than we might think, especially if we're feeling sort of individually or collectively as a father and a family, like down, there are interesting places to turn where you can get some answers, and where it doesn't necessarily have to be about working on yourself. You can be like, I want to put my energy into working on this family. I want to put my energy into building my relationship with my sons. And then maybe in this session, it'll be about building my parenting relationship with my wife or my spousal relationship with my spouse. We found it enormously beneficial, and we got tools, and my sons got tools that I think a lot of boys don't learn until very late, about how to express themselves, what to do when someone makes themselves vulnerable to you expressing yourself, and like how to take that in. I mean, they're young and they're human, so they, like me and their mom, don't always do that stuff perfectly, but they got some tools that I think will serve them in relationships of all kinds as they grow up.
That's amazing that you did that you recognized, yeah, we're not going to solve this with an audiobook on parenting. Like, we're going to go get some real resources behind this, and that your boys were part of it and they saw their mom and dad make time for that, or commit to that, or include them in that, or just get to a point where that's important enough to do at all, I think is a really powerful thing for them to bear witness, even if they don't fully grasp it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think the words you used like really capture what it was about. It was about inclusion. You know, it was sort of like these kids are going to be part of the solution. And I want to be clear, as is the case every time we've ever talked to mental health professionals about our family and our sons, is it's mostly the grownups who could use the fixing. You know, the kids are kids, you know, and they've got stuff that they're working on. But, you know, it's a little easier to work on the adults. And, you know, and we were sort of ready to dig in and do that work. But you know, my boys did participate, and they did go through sessions that some were easy for them and some were hard for them and hard on them. I don't know if they'll remember it much, because certainly my younger guy was pretty young while much of it was happening. But I think they came to see it as time we were together. And, you know, we'd just go do something like go to Jimmy John's or Hannah's Pretzel or something afterward. And, you know, just try to, like, if we had a good vibe or even a tough vibe coming out of that meeting, like try to just kind of huddle up as a family and do something that was a little lighter and a little more fun. So yeah, I mean, that's the things you mentioned is what it was about. It was about inclusion, and it was about specificity. Like, not just parenting in general, like these two, how do we do it better with these two as the two people that we are? And, you know, I think largely we've done that. We still backslide and make mistakes. Obviously, as I said, the learning from mistakes is key. And one of the learnings is that you'll continue to make mistakes. But, you know, I think we benefited from that.
It sounds like this shift in your creative practice, moving from, you know, highly disciplined first thing in the morning, you know, in that kind of quiet time before the rest of the world's awake. Now, how does writing look for you?
Yeah. So it often looks like evenings when they go to bed. And also, you know, occasionally like carving out a couple hours on a weekend. Tiffany's actually in a play right now. And so that means there are evenings where once the boys go to bed, I'm kind of on my own. And if I've got anything left, especially if, like on those Saturday night shows, I might really just, like last Saturday, I started at 9 and I quit at 1:30 in the morning. It wasn't all writing the entire time, but it was a bunch of it was like writing or writing adjacent work. And I was just sort of like, you know, you just kind of got to take the opportunities when they come. It's an entirely different model. You know, the model used to be go to your desk in the morning and use your sort of starting to work as the way of like inviting the muse to show up. Like make sure the muse knows what time every day to show up, and then maybe he or she shows up more often. And now it's more like a model like I heard Neil Young describe once as like, look, if I get an idea, I leave whatever I'm doing to go do it. Now, I can't quite do that, but I do try to treat those moments of epiphany with great respect. I'm like, maybe I can't leave where I'm at and go to my desk and write it as it should be written, but I'm definitely going to record an audio note into this phone or send myself an email or jot this down on a card or in a notebook. I send myself a lot of email. and sometimes that stuff is sometimes incredibly, it comes out like almost finished. Other times it's just like, okay, I remember what I was thinking about. Now, how do I articulate this? But I do try to treat those moments like with great respect because, you can't make them come, and I don't have daily opportunities necessarily to make them come. But if you count those moments, like I write with some frequency. That's just not what writing used to mean to me. The epiphany moments and the kind of inspiration moments and those moments when your brain is kind of solving a problem in your work almost in the background, and then the solution kind of just moves into the foreground of your mind and you're like, oh, wait, yeah, I could just do that. That'd be a fun thing to try or an interesting thing to try. I try to get that stuff down and get it on the page or somehow so that when I do get a little more time, I can shape it. But that, you know, I can't just say, oh, I'll remember that, because I just don't. It goes.
Yeah, I feel like my hard drive is like nearly full almost all the time.
Right.
And my son's is like wide open and like terabytes bigger than mine. And yeah. And I just max out. I'm just like, I have no more brain. And he's like, I have only brain, like fill me with data, Dad, you know? And I'm like, I got nothing.
I know. That's what it feels like sometimes. I totally hear you. And, you know, some of that is like, I don't know. Do you feel like you're getting enough sleep these last few years?
Yeah. Maris is a master of sleep training. Both of our children were sleeping through the night by 3 months.
Oh, that's amazing.
It saved our marriage. You know, I honestly, I don't know, like you described, like being sleep deprived and trying to function in, you know, highly strategic, highly creative capacities. And for both of us to be full-time parents and, you know, Maris returning to work after 3 months, there's no way we could do it. Like she's got a commute down to the University of Chicago. Like she'd fall asleep at the wheel. Like there's just no, there's no wiggle room there. And so she's just gangster about it and had both of our kids sleeping through the night. And a good night's sleep, man, you could accomplish the world on a good night's sleep.
Oh, for sure.
And so
for sure. Yeah.
We prioritize that above nearly everything. And, I give her 100% of the credit for making that possible.
You guys were dealing with kind of a deadline because like the going back to work thing, that is, that's real for the moms. I mean, I just, you know, I work with a lot of women who have children, and I've watched them come back, and boy, you know, I've got a lot of admiration for it, because I think the pressure that they're under personally, you know, at home and at work, even at a place like our work, where I feel like there's a fair amount of support and understanding, though it would be up to them to say, not me, I suppose, just how good that is. You know, it just looks tough. It's tough, and it's tougher than I think it is for dads in a lot of ways, even though, you know, it's tough on dads too, but man, it looks pretty tough for the moms.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping that in some tiny way, at least amongst men, this show gives a little visibility into some of that, because I didn't have a lot of good resources for how to think and feel about things in the 9 months leading up to it. And certainly afterwards, it's, you know, on one hand, you either hear like, oh man, yeah, it's awesome. The, you know, your wife's going to do most of the work. Your job is just going to be there to, like, you know, in a couple months, like, start playing with the kid. Or, which is just like insane.
right.
Or the opposite, where it's just like, oh man, your life's over, dude. Like, I hope you understand. Like, I'm probably not going to see you for the next 18 years. So there's that, you know, and like, yeah. both ends of the spectrum are complete horseshit, you know, awful advice and just a terrible perspective on things. And somewhere in the middle is like the truth, but no one spends time there. You know, it's either like ribbing someone and giving them a hard time, or it's just people who aren't engaged or don't get engaged until later. Like, oh, they're just kind of a blob in the beginning. And, you know, you'll really start to play with them, you know, when they're crawling. And it's like, that's like 8 months away, dude. Like, that's, what do I do for the next 8 months?
And I found it like, you know, the bonding, though, you know, like the bonding was not automatic either. Like, I felt like I had to put a little something into that, you know, like it wasn't like it was just going to happen and then I'll just show up. Like, I mean, these boys, you know, for a very long time, they were much more crazy about their mom than they were about me. And I think, you know, I've actually heard that from a fair number of dads, with their little boys in particular. But you know, like it was, you know, I'd be like, you know, I need to do a little work. I need to show a little value here. What are the things dad can do that are fun? Like, you know, mom doesn't perhaps have as much fun, you know, rolling them around on the bed or something like that. That is kind of one of the things that maybe only I do, or lifting them up in the air or something like that. So, you know, I was like, sort of like, I need my dad differentiated offerings here, that are not things mom is either, willing or ready or able to do. So I was like, I need to do a little marketing of myself here in my own family.
I love it, man. Yeah. Last question. I'm curious, does being a writer make you a better or worse father?
Better, with this condition. So long as I am not doing what I had been doing, which is beating the shit out of myself for not writing enough or writing well enough to be enough of a person, at which point, when I was really down in those depths, I wasn't good for anyone, myself or my sons or my wife. But definitely, you know, writing creates an opportunity, whether you publish the work or not, to investigate and articulate how you feel about something. And a lot of that work recently for me in the last years has been about being a father and about being a son. I definitely feel like I am a better dad for having figured out some of those things. I think is a little bit of what I can bring uniquely to fatherhood for my sons that, you know, that being a writer opens up in terms of the way I can talk to them about books, the kind of graphic novels that I can put in their hands, the reading I can do with them, the way we can kind of think about various texts they look at and the angles we can take on it. So I actually think I'm committed enough a father now, and fatherhood is integrated enough into my identity now that if writing truly made me kind of irredeemably worse as a father, I think I probably would have stopped by now. But I think I found a way for it to make me better, which is probably what makes it largely possible for me to keep doing it in the fashion I'm doing it.
Thanks so much, Dave. I really enjoyed our conversation. I feel like we haven't talked life in a really long time. I feel like, you know, we pop into each other's lives when there's some kind of work-related thing that brings us together. But a chance to just kind of hear your philosophy towards fatherhood and what you've been up to creatively has been really great. Thank you for that.
I can't wait to listen to the other shows you're doing and to learn from these other dads, as I feel like I learned from you today too. So, you know, there's lots of learning for all of us to do. And there's lots of, I think, commiseration and inspiration to be had in whatever community can spring up around this. So I think it's an exciting thing. I think it's a worthy thing. And I appreciate you inviting me to be a part of it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.